Hello, interwebs, and welcome to Close Up. I'm your host, Joe, and joining us again is Justin for part two.
Stand in, Ryan.
For part two. Yeah. For part two of the Leisure List we started a couple weeks back, because these things always go on for a very long time. But content, you know, that's good. You like to hear us review all these things. We watch a lot of things. So this show's just becoming Leisure List at this point. But let's get back to where we left off. What you got?
All right. So it's another game. I've been playing Ghostwire Tokyo for the past little while. I'll probably finish it, maybe. I don't know. First off, the game is gorgeous. I've been playing it on my PS5, and running high frame rate and high, high graphics and everything. This game is gorgeous. It's probably the best looking game I have seen on PlayStation 5 yet, and it takes advantage of a lot of what the system can do. Like, it's not the best looking at all times, but some areas it looks really, really good, especially since it's always nighttime, and 90% of the time it's either raining or there's puddles on the ground, so the reflections are beautiful. Some areas are rougher than others, but some of them are, like, some portions of the game almost look photorealistic. It's very cool. The combat is unique. It's not like the smoothest. It's a Bethesda game, so take that with a grain of salt. The combat isn't the smoothest, but it's still pretty cool. The enemies are all interesting. There's a lot of interesting stuff to it, and it's cool. You know, with all the Japan stuff that's going on in the game. I'll probably finish it just because I am enjoying it very, very thoroughly. Like, you go around and you're like, oh, I can talk to dogs and I can talk to cats and stuff.
Cool.
But it's pretty cool. I don't know. It seems
like a very different kind of game for Bethesda.
Yes, yeah, it doesn't really play like a Bethesda game. I was actually caught off guard that it was a Bethesda game, but it's definitely one that I recommend at least playing it once just to give it a shot, because it is really beautiful to look at. Mm-hmm. And gameplay's fun, the characters are kind of cool. It's unique, that's for sure. And the atmosphere is very eerie. Everyone is gone. It's like they just all turned into dust, and there's, like, clothing remains of everybody just exactly where they were. It's very eerie, and you're basically, like, fighting a shitload of Slendermans, basically. Mm. Like, they look exactly like it.
But for copyright purposes or not.
Yeah. I don't know. Honestly, it's so precise. Maybe it's because they hold the umbrella and that's how they get away with it. It's like, no, it's Slenderman with an umbrella.
Completely different kind of thing.
Completely different thing. It's kind of cool. They use the umbrellas as, like, shields. And you're like, no! It's cool, though.
That's cool. All right, another comic book, Superman, War World Rising by Philip Kennedy Johnson, Daniel Sampier, and Adriano Lucas. This was a brilliant comic. Philip Kennedy Johnson is wise enough to let art tell the story, sans dialogue, for multiple whole pages, which is funny because I read a lot of Silver Age comics and Golden Age as well. You know, those are considerably more wordy than modern comics. But it's very rare I see a comic like this where the art tells the story so thoroughly and there's actually so little dialogue. They really let the visual medium speak for itself. Philip Kennedy Johnson, I guess, you know, I don't want to say other writers are egotistical, but, you know, he knew when to step back and let the art really, it is gorgeous art, you know, as well. The detailing, the facial expressions, the designs, and I especially love the use of color to communicate mood more often than I usually notice that. And story-wise, this is the best Superman comic I've read since the rebirth run, where he was a dad on the farm. This story forces Superman into an actual political corner and with the Justice League, where his morals contradict with the political reality. So basically what happens is there's a ship from Warworld that attacks Earth, and they deal with that. They deal with the alien invasion. But then there's this piece of technology that gets left behind and some political prisoners. And Atlantis, you know, Aquaman and Atlantis, they handle them. They take the technology, they take the political prisoners. But this technology, the U.S. government wants it. So the U.S. government tries to send in some members of the Suicide Squad, and they get captured. Actually, I don't remember if it was Suicide Squad or just CIA, but they get captured, they get caught by Atlantis, and Atlantis is like, okay, surface dwellers, foreign militaries trying to invade our sovereignty and steal this technology, which we claim by right, because it landed in the ocean. So then Atlantis and the U.S. are on the brink of war, and Superman's like, meanwhile, with Superman, when they took down all these alien ships, they found out that there were Kryptonian survivors aboard, which he took back to the Fortress of Solitude to rehabilitate them. And he's like, okay, so there's Kryptonian survivors from Warworld right now. Like, Mongol is up to something weird here. There's this technology that the U.S. and Atlantis are about to go to war over. And then Superman interferes in these political sovereignty affairs and basically runs afoul of the Justice League and the United States government and Atlantis all in one fell swoop just by actively trying to stop a war. Because Superman just steals the piece of technology and he's like, nope, I'm not letting this happen. Sorry, I'm getting into spoilers, but, you know, this is part one of a saga, so there's a lot more that's going to be going on from this, but anyway, sorry, I'm spoiling things. But what I'm just, my entire point is I really enjoy that, like, even the Justice League can't condone Superman standing up for what he believes to be morally right at this point, because it conflicts with politics. The Justice League aren't supposed to get into the affairs of politics, and Superman's directly putting himself into the line of fire where the U.S. government wants to go to war. And he's like, no, I'm literally not letting you do this. And they're like, okay, you're Superman, and we don't want to, you know, have a beef with you, but you're giving us very little choice here. So you really feel the emotional weight on Clark and his son. Also, the other thing that's weighing over everything is Superman wants to go to Warworld next to help resolve whatever's happening there with these political prisoners and these Kryptonians who came for his help. But his son, who's been to the future, has seen the history books and knows that Clark basically disappears from the history books when he goes off to Warworld. So it's like, Dad, if you go out there, I'm pretty sure you're never coming back. Like you're out of history at this point. And he's like, you know what, John? One thing I've learned is that history isn't set in stone. We have to trust that our actions can change the future. And I'll be back, I promise. But John's worried because he's seen the future. doesn't want him to go. So the character work feels very mature. The conflicts are believable. The moral quandaries are fascinating. I think Superman fans need to read this book ASAP. It's very well done. And just part one of a series, which I've been told is one of the best Superman runs of all time. I'm not that far in, but it's a great start. So I also watched Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. I'm a bit mixed on it. I think there's lots to like in here. The actors, the production design, the stunt work, especially the wire work, is insanely well done. The narrative structure also feels unique to me with how deep into the film new exposition is still being delivered, which recontextualizes things. I'm like, oh, wow, usually I'm used to the first act dealing with exposition, dumping stuff, and then we just get off to the races and go chronologically from there. But this film is constantly giving you new information, which recontextualizes the rest of it, and introducing new characters. I'm like, okay, this is weird, but I kind of like it. I'm into that. Problem is, despite being mentally intrigued by the subject matter, the film left me mostly bored because the characters felt too emotionally detached and reserved, and the action scenes rarely felt organic or consequential to the overall story. It was interesting, but it didn't, there's really no emotional resonance for me. It's just sort of a mental exercise of, yeah, that was cool. I'd still say it's worth a watch for how much it does well, despite its themes and story not resonating with me. That's Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. All next right. For you.
Yeah. So I'm going to go with the last game on my list here. I'm going to pronounce it the way the game does. Nier Automata. And I have absolutely no idea how I missed this game when it came out. This is probably one of the best games I have played in a long time. It is an absolute must play. The combat is completely unique. I've never had a game before that's forced me to need to take on the crab orientation on my controller, like double trigger fingers. You've got all at once, you've got like shooting and swordplay at the same time, and like that's special cool stuff, and it's wild. It's the combat is a blast. The story is fantastic. The whole universe they've created here is really cool. Like, it's the themes are so consistent throughout, and it tells such a good story. It's a very bleak story. Mm-hmm. You're dealing with androids, and then the androids are trying to wipe out the robots on Earth, and it's a bleak look on war and life, and there's a lot of deep philosophical messages in there, and this is all the brain, like, from one guy kind of really directs this whole thing. And he's like a genius when it comes to this. Like, it's absolutely incredible. Visually, you know, it looks cool. It's nothing to write home about visually, but it's so unique in the way it presented its story, and the themes are so cool. And there's just so much going on with it. It's also, despite me saying that it's bleak, it's also got a sense of humor to it. Mm-hmm. So
that's good.
Which is cool. Like it's not like a, it's like a little bit of a dark humor type thing, and it's absolutely excellent. Like I can't believe I missed this game. I started playing it and I absolutely blew through the whole thing. Basically every day I'm like, I gotta play this game because it was just so good. I don't usually go back and play a game again. This one, I probably will in like another year. I will go back and play it again because it's absolutely phenomenal. It's just that good.
Was this the one that had multiple characters, or was that a different one?
Yes, that is, yeah, yeah. I don't want to go too far into it. Like, maybe. It's kind of spoiler territory.
Just tell the people what they're missing in general terms.
You know what? Yeah. The game kind of has a psych out when it comes to the ending. There's no, like, it's hard to tell where the game actually ends because there's a lot of credit rolls that you go through during this game. It's pretty interesting with that. I've never seen a game do this before where I'm going to spoil it a little bit. If you're interested in playing it, don't listen to this, but you run through the story as one character with your sidekick, you know, tagging along. And then you do it again from the sidekick's point of view. And I thought that was so cool because he's a completely different skill set and you play entirely differently through the same story. And then there are parts that you see differently because they're not always together. So there are some unique parts to it. It's just very, very well done. And it did some really creative things. And I think that comes down to the fact that there's one really hands-on lead creative to the game. Like it's Square Enix published it, but they basically have nothing to do with it. It's kind of like Hideo Kojima. You know how he's try to stay away from touching his stuff because he's got his own thing, and then you know he branched out and made his own company now. But Square Enix basically just acts as the publisher, and it's still a big crew that's made this game, but there's one really hands-on lead creative who has really designed much of this game, and it's absolutely incredible for it.
Cool. Well, I watched 8 Mile, which is largely just known as the movie that Eminem made an Oscar-winning song for. Lose Yourself, which is, you know, if you were to ask anyone who doesn't know Eminem music, that's probably the first thing they'll say. That song is one of the rare cases where just like one song on a soundtrack completely transcends the movie it came from. But I figured, okay, I know the song. What's 8 Mile actually about? I came away feeling like it was a story about pride. Because Eminem's character in 8 Mile, most of the things in his life are problems because he has way too much pride about, or lack of pride about his situation. He's, he's stuck living with his mom in a trailer park, in a factory job nobody respects. They're like, oh, that factory, that's the worst factory in Detroit, you know. He's just recently out of a relationship. He's got no prospects. His friends are kind of idiots. And, you know, and he gets, every time he goes up to these, the first time in the opening scene, when he tries to do the rap battle, you know, he chokes and embarrasses himself in front of the whole community who goes to these rap battles. Even though he is naturally very talented at this freestyling battle rap, but all the pride gets in his head. And I feel like that was a large part of it, was because so many things in his life are very easy to pick apart. When he goes into a battle rap, he's already self-conscious of all the things his opponents are going to throw against him in a rap situation. Like, because there's a lot you can pick apart and just demolish this guy's self-worth. So he just chokes right away because he's like, well, like, I can fight, but, like, they're going to tear me down like nothing. So most of the movie is about him coming to terms with his situation and finding the maturity to just to say, well, you know what? Like, maybe I'm living with my mom and it's a bad situation, but, you know, I've got a family and I've got a job and I don't have much, but I'm going to make the most of what I've got. You know, even though life kind of sucks, he just learns not to self-pity so much, basically. So it's a pretty darn good story. Because it's a story about pride holding you back from your potential. He's a smart guy, but he's afraid to put himself on the line when it really counts. So basically, the movie is just get over yourself and you know, do the things you do well, which I can get behind. It's inspiring in some ways and just well presented in general.
So is that the point of the song then as well?
The song basically tells the story of the movie.
Got it.
It's the song that plays over the end credits. If you listen to the song, it basically is just running down the plot of the movie. So it's actually a pretty good summary. So I also read Batman Detective Comics, The Neighborhood by Mariko Tamaki, Dan Mora, Victor Bogdanovic, and Jordi Belair. So this one is also still taking place in that era where Batman is post-Joker War, Batman's stripped down to basics, and there's that crusading mayor who's still out to get rid of all the vigilantes. But in this one, we see that now that Bruce Wayne isn't rich enough to afford being in a mansion, he has to live in a very high-class Gotham neighborhood. So once again, he's not poor. He has to live in a high-class neighborhood, but they call it the neighborhood because that's part of the whole thing, is Bruce Wayne has to deal with having neighbors now, which is kind of a funny thing that's played up, like, oh, I have to act like my nosy neighbor is, you know, bugging me and whatever, and I actually have to go to parties on the block now if I don't want to look like this weird loner guy in the neighborhood now. But that also backfires on him completely, being the weird loner guy, because somebody gets murdered in the neighborhood and then he ends up being the prime suspect as Bruce Wayne, because they're like, oh yeah, that Bruce Wayne, he always keeps to himself and he's weird, and he's like, damn it, I didn't this was not the problem. And to make it worse, the woman who got murdered, her father is like super rich, super influential crime boss guy, and he wants revenge against Bruce Wayne specifically. And this is the kind of guy who, some spoilers, but later on in the book, this guy just like walks up to a police station with a bazooka in broad daylight. Well, it wasn't broad daylight, but like, you know, the guy's nuts and doesn't care what he does, and he can just get away with anything, basically. I liked how brutal that villain was. He's like a walking tank, and he's drawn like it. He's just huge and intimidating. What else was going on? Oh yeah, and then there was this weird, like, what was actually happening with the murder, which is basically like there was a parasite kind of thing going around. And then some of the backup issues were about Huntress. And personally, out of this comic volume, that was the most interesting stuff to me, because I never read any Huntress stories. So seeing some backup issues featuring Huntress. I'm like, okay, cool. Now I'm kind of getting to know this character. And she is mostly trying to avenge the death of this friend she made in this neighborhood. Just because nobody else is really looking into it. So she's like, well, I feel like it's my responsibility to figure out who committed this murder. And that brings her in line with Batman because they're kind of working on the same thing. The stuff with Mayor Nakano trying to get rid of vigilantes, that, you know, that stick is starting to wear thin already because I've read a lot of these books and he's been very prominent. I'm like, okay, it's kind of interesting what he's doing, but I read a lot about this already. Thing about this book is there's lots of setup, but not much payoff yet. The art didn't especially stand out to me either, especially the inking and the colors. But, you know, the Detective Comics, the neighborhood, intriguing enough to be worth a read. You're up.
All right. So on the last episode, I talked about Sweet Tooth. I was stuck in the middle of season two, so I finally finished it up. The second season was fine. It still kind of sucked. It was just not near as good as the first season. Like almost consistently across every character. They were all just, every character sucked somehow. So the whole second season was pretty well let down. I mean, it got better from the point I was at. And then the third season turned out all right. The third season was pretty good, and the ending, it sort of shifted. It kind of goes from being a very more scientific-based, like, it's scientific, and, you know, they're kind of trying to figure out this virus and these children through science, and it sort of takes a more mystical, religious tone coming to the third season, so that was a bit of a let down for me because I really liked that aspect in the first season. But the ending was still cool, and it was really cool because there's a frame tale and they got to actually end the show, which was cool, especially with Netflix, like, canceling stuff early all the time. So the show actually wrapped itself up. It told the whole story, and it was a pretty satisfying ending. Honestly, I wish they just, like, you could almost just take the whole second season and throw it in the garbage and put season one and three together. Like, literally, the cliffhanger from the end of season one doesn't pick up till the beginning of season three, essentially.
And like, season two, I guess, doesn't...
Like, you could almost
just
take season two and throw it out completely. like there's a, bit of stuff, but...
So watch season one, watch a highlight reel of what's important from season two.
Honestly, and then watch season three. Yeah, honestly, season two was basically a waste of time. It was just not
good.
That's
too bad.
Yeah.
Well, Netflix got what they wanted. They dragged out their revenue for a whole other year and finished the show for good measure. So, who needs to do it well when you can do it longer?
Longer.
That's the TV mantra.
Better, yeah. Always better.
All right. So, I read this book, which is called Ship of Gold in the Deep Blue Sea by Gary Kinder. And this book was an inspiring story of the real life attempt to uncover one of the largest shipwrecks of gold ever sunk. Not necessarily the largest shipwreck. I mean, largest cargo of gold. Basically, the story bounces back and forth between two timelines. There is the timeline about the survivors of the vessel, the Central America, which went down in the mid-1800s, which is pieced together through accounts from survivors and tells the story of a lot of the people whose lives were lost the day the ship went down. But not just about the day the ship went down. It was the couple of weeks leading up to the shipwreck and how they ended up in that situation in the first place, going all the way through the ship being in peril. And it took days for this ship to go down. The guys were bailing water for their lives the entire time until it finally went down. And even after it went down and people were trying to be saved, there was still more after that. The survivors had to stay floating on wreckage for either until they got picked up days later or they died. Most of them died. So even surviving the wreck wasn't enough to ensure survival indefinitely. So the story goes between the wreck itself and the efforts of a group of scientists and oceanographers and treasure hunters, investors in the mid-80s looking for this shipwreck. And that's where the real meat of the story is, because all that flashback stuff is really just a setup that these were real people carrying very precious cargo, and they went through a real tragedy. But now we're going to unearth that. And the thing about it is, this could be a very cynical story, but the main character, Tommy, who, once again, is a real guy. This is a real story. He wasn't really in it for the treasure hunt. He was mostly interested in expanding the scientific field of deep ocean exploration. And finding this treasure was really just a convenient excuse to get a bunch of investors together to provide an opportunity to get better technologies. Because everyone was interested in finding this sunken treasure. So he's like, fine, if we have to find this sunken, if finding a sunken treasure is what'll get people to invest money into better technologies for ocean research, then yeah, let's do that. And also, finding treasure sounds awesome. But there's a whole lot more to it than that, because they had to make sure that they kept this whole operation under wraps. They had to do years worth of research just to narrow down the area. Then they had to get investors on board to pay for this. It was a one, you know, it was a very, very long shot they'd actually find the place, because the records of where the ship went down were very spotty. And the main guy, Tommy here, he was very influential in getting these investors, because they all liked how honest he was. He never said, oh yeah, this is going to be a sure thing. He was always very upfront. This is a very, very long shot, but here's our plan. And he was very well-spoken and explained himself well enough that he gave people confidence that he could do it. And the book is all about the twists and turns he went through trying to keep his operation under wraps and the information hidden from competitors all the way up to when they finally find the site and competitors are closing in on them. How do they claim the site? They literally have to go to court and change the law, like change outdated maritime laws just to be able to claim salvage on this site. They have to, then once they find the site, they have to figure out how to claim the wreckage without damaging any of the gold on board. They have to invent brand new kinds of robotics and surveying technologies, and like, these guys did a lot of work in a lot of different fields, and like the treasure once again, that's just the end goal, but it's really about the journey to find the treasure. And as far as real life stories go, it's actually really cool. It's a story of ingenuity and thinking outside the box more than anything, because that was Tommy's whole thing. Was when he first started on this, people thought what he was doing was impossible, but he was convinced that the task wasn't impossible. People just hadn't thought of a good way to do it yet. And he made it a reality just through sheer tenacity and not accepting impossibility for an answer. So another movie I watched was the 1995 live action Casper movie. Christina Ricci was incredible in it for a child star, and Bill Pullman was amusing in it. But the film's humor didn't generally land for me. I found the plot lacked any sort of focus or character development past the first act. But there's still some sweet moments near the end, which made me sad. I like the themes of unfinished business and parent-child relationships, especially those strong enough to affect the barrier between life and death. There is some interesting things in here, but the execution was fun if you turn your brain off. All right.
Yeah, I remember watching that movie as a kid and remembering that it was like, even then the humor was like, oh, okay. And
it's a little off.
Yeah, it's just not, it's almost like cringe humor, right?
A little bit.
Like Casper is cringy himself. You're just like, why? And I just remember that being my feeling, even as a child watching that movie, and like, the movie just was like a mess.
I feel that, like I did watch
it's
this.
It's good, but yeah.
I feel like I saw, like, I have such vague memories. I think I did see this movie as a kid, but I was very, very little. I think I watched it on VHS or something, and probably not even the whole thing. I think I only saw some of it. Maybe even just the openings. Like, so that's one reason I wanted to watch it again, because I'm like, I haven't seen this in a very, very long time, and I don't know if I ever even finished it.
I remember the second one being a little bit better, but still, that weird cringe humor.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's Casper. What's next?
All right. Let's see. So I read a book called Unsold. It's part of the Cradle series by Will White. And it's really interesting. It's very, very cool. It's sort of like this nomadic society that, and they all kind of do, it's almost like magic. They can do certain forms, but more like physical magic. Like, it's more like a magic plus martial arts sort of thing. Sure. And everybody's got like their rankings in societies and stuff. And the main character is an unsold. So they do like a soul test, and it's like, oh, everybody else gets like, oh, you're a hammersmith, or, you know, you're a warrior, or, and then he's just like, they're like, you got nothing. You're useless. And the way he's written this society that totally looks down on him, and like, they just look at him like he's so utterly useless, and they're like, like, literally, it's described this way multiple times. Somebody who's of like an iron rank, which is like children or bronze rank, and then they get to iron rank when they're a little bit stronger, but like, some adults, more frequent than not, the adults kind of peak out at upper iron rank, but there's no like real ranking in there, and then some of them make it to like the emerald rank. But they're like, an iron rank could just like kill him on the street, and they'd be like, yeah, all right. Like for the slightest thing, they could just be like, yeah, no, you killed the Unsold. Like, he doesn't matter, and he has to speak differently to everyone. He's like, he has to address them. He's like, oh, this one would like to go to the bathroom, or something like that. Like,
I see.
Like it was a really unique style of writing, and I just thought like the system was really cool, and watching it from that perspective was really unique. I haven't read something like that before. It's not like I made it sound sort of like with that, you know, oh, you get classified. It makes it sound like it's like a young adult novel. I don't really think it is. It's more mature than that, definitely. Even though the character is a bit younger, as far as I can remember.
But yeah, it was just read YA though.
No, yeah, it really doesn't. It deals with some pretty heavy subjects, and the main character himself is like so sneaky. He just does everything dirty because he's so weak that they make him fight children. They're like, oh, we have our annual fighting competition, and he's like, they're like, yeah, he's fighting like 6 year olds. He's like fighting 6 to 8 year olds because they're like, you're that useless. Wow. And he's like, even if I lose, I'm embarrassed. And there's this whole, they're all about appearances, like your honor and your outward appearance as a clan and as a family and as a person. You have your appearance to keep up. And he's like constantly, he's like, if I lose to a child, which is possible because they refuse to teach him any martial art stuff because he's Unsold. They're like, oh, he's like dirty. They're like, they don't want anything to do with him. So they don't teach him anything. He's not allowed to touch anything. And it's like, oh, but he's allowed to fight, but he's got to fight like 8 year olds. And he's like, okay, so I might lose to an 8 year old and lose all my face, basically. Like, I'm so useless, and it affects so negatively against his family. And the family dynamic with that as well is really interesting, because the mom doesn't really care, but the dad is like, totally looks down on him, and the sister is normal, and kind of, she tries to help him, but at the same time is realistic.
Right. Just but knowing you just, is going to be worse for me.
Yeah, but they have conversations where it's like, well, if I have this thing that helps me win my fight, it can offset you losing your fight against an 8 year old, the embarrassment for our family, right? Mm-hmm. But like, there's a high chance he could lose to an 8 year old, but he's like, I gain nothing from winning against 8 year olds. They're just going to be like, well, of course the bigger kid won against the 8 year olds. He's like, almost 18. Of course he can fight 8 year olds. He's like, there's no winning in this for me. But it's just, it was very interesting. I'm very interested to see where it goes, because it obviously, that's where it starts, and then he goes off on his adventure, which is pushed in a different direction. He kind of breaks his fate, and that's kind of the theme of the story. So I'm interested to see where that goes. I'm definitely going to read the next one, but it's very unique, and like more than probably like 60 to 70% of the book takes place in this starting village, though. And it's really unique. I really enjoyed it.
I like the sound of it.
Yeah.
Sounds cool. I watched Nicolas Cage Ghost Rider in 2007. So there's lots that's not good about this movie. The acting is wooden, even by Cage, which is weird. The special effects are largely poor. The editing is very in your face. The dialogue is atrocious. And for me, this is a bad one. The film's halfway point is probably where its first act should have ended. Because, like, he only embraces being Ghost Rider, like, halfway through the movie. And then I'm like, this is like a... This is like an end of the first act sort of thing. You pushed it to the end, like halfway through the movie. Come on. Anyway. Good, though. There are still cool bits of Ghost Rider action. And I love that in Ghost Rider form, he's just brutally efficient with the way he dispatches bad guys. Even the tough ones. It's like going into a video game and like every bad guy in this movie is like a boss fight. That he just dispatches in one go. Like, when he faces the bad guys, he deals with them. It's over. So I like that there wasn't, you know, any tiptoeing around that. He's just like, no, when he's fighting, he is extremely competent as a hero. The bad guys in this movie are delightfully hammy. And the movie all around is so strange, it's actually a bit charming. So, it's one of those weird cases where I'm like, there's so much that's like very clearly not good, but it's still okay if you turn off your brain. It's weirdly kind of charming. Looking forward to watching Spirit of Vengeance, though, because I've heard that's better. So, another comic book. Superman. Son of Kal-El, Volume 1, The Truth, by Tom Taylor and John Timms. This one, all right, so there was that War World Rising comic. So Superman is generally split up into two titles. There's Action Comics, usually featuring Superman, and the actual Superman book. So in this era of DC, with Clark Kent dealing with the War World Rising thing, he ends up going to War World and Superman's off planet, which leaves his son, John Kent, to indefinitely take on the role as main Superman. And so Clark Kent, at least as far as this Superman series is gone, he's gone. So Clark Kent's now the star of Action Comics and John Kent's the star of the Superman book. At least in this era. Which I thought was kind of cool right from the get-go. Like, this is volume one. I even like that cover that I showed you there, which was very symbolic because that yellow border and the way John's flying there, that's the cover, effectively, of Superman number one from 80 years ago. So they're basically saying, just based on the cover art there, that like, yeah, this is Superman number one, like for real. And even in the very first issue, Clark Kent usually has these blue thought boxes where he's, you know, describes his inner monologues and all that. And I was surprised to see immediately that the blue text boxes are John's now. Like, oh, okay, right away, Superman number one. All right, you're giving John the blue text boxes, passing of the torch instantly. Cool, sure. But what really separates John from Clark is his political activism. Because that's one thing Clark tells him is that I wasn't born here, so I always felt a little bit weird interfering with politics directly. But you're a son of two worlds. You're the son of me and of Lois Lane. And like I'm from another world and was raised here. Like, Earth is your home through and through. So, like, Clark feels like John has more leeway to kind of do what he wants. Be a Superman that he never felt comfortable being. So John is a lot more politically aggressive than Clark, which I think is kind of cool. He's nearly like, for those of you who have read Golden Age Superman, which is one of my favorite versions of Superman, He's a lot more like the original Champion of the Oppressed that Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster wrote from the very beginning. The guy that's just like anything oppressive, even in the middle of America, forget it. I'm going to stand up to like to cops and the government and the powers that be. I'm not letting any tyranny stand. Like a good scene in the book was when all these illegal immigrants come into the U.S. that he just saved. He just saved these people from a foreign government in the, like their ship was sinking in the middle of the sea, and he brings them aboard American shores. And these are just normal people who happen to be from a dictatorship company. They're refugees. They're seeking asylum, which I believe he even points out, like Superman himself is a refugee from a dying planet. So he just saved all these refugees, gets on to the shores of America, and these cops start arresting them immediately, throwing handcuffs on them. And then John flies back in. He's like, hey, what the heck's going on, guys? Like, you know, is there not a better way to do this? These aren't criminals. I brought them here to save them. They're refugees. And if you're going to arrest them, you have to arrest me too. So the cops slap the cuffs on Superman. And it's like, okay, well, yep, he's a different... And then, you know, then Clark bails him out of jail. This is before Clark went to our world. But it's like, okay, yeah, this is a different kind of Superman. This is the guy who's going to handcuff himself alongside the refugees. He's not going to, you know, hurt the cops or anything because they're doing their jobs. But he's making a point.
Well, yeah, definitely he's making a point because it's like, well, yeah, Superman wearing handcuffs, he could just go, boop, I'm out.
Yeah.
Like, that's really interesting that they, like, the symbolism there is really, really, really good. That's cool.
Yeah, so this is the kind of Superman he is. He's, well, let me see. I think the back even, yeah. So the classic Superman saying is truth, justice, and the American way. But Jonathan Kent's new saying for the modern Superman is truth, justice, and a better world. I also really liked what Clark Kent says about him as his successor. Clark described, he says something along the lines of, I'm the man of tomorrow, and you're for all the days after. So that really establishes what John is to Clark. He's the legacy of Superman and can be, Clark is the ideal to strive towards, and John is the one who can really bring it into the future. So the other thing that's going on with John is he has this new love interest, which is this boy that he meets from in college, who's like kind of a Lois Lane stand-in. He's like a super fan of Lois Lane. And John's like, you know, that's kind of funny. Most people are like fans of my dad, but cool. You're like my mom's number one fan. Sure. So it's kind of basically most of this volume is establishing Jonathan's new supporting cast, which is mostly the people we already knew he was friends with, like Damian Wayne, Batman's son, was always his best friend. So like Damian Wayne, Lois Lane, this new character, Jay, and a couple other people as Clark's heading off world. So it does a pretty good job of setting up his new status quo. Definitely worth a read. Not a perfect all around story. It's a little thin in some parts, but it's a good basis for a new status quo. Worth a read.
All right. Not going to talk about it too long because I know you guys did an episode on it, but I finished Vox Machina season 3. Excellent as always. I can't remember what I had to say about it before. I remember disagreeing with what Ryan said about it. But,
so you hated it?
No. Not with quite. Every fiber Ryan, of Ryan, being. Ryan put up a stink. He had an issue with it, and I had the exact opposite feeling. And it might have been about the, what's the thing with Scanlan that got dropped out?
Oh, the Bard's Lament.
Yeah.
I think that was more, I don't know. Was it me you were disagreeing with, though?
No, I had this argument at work. Yeah, I just remember, I know you brought that up in the episode, but I don't remember what I had the opposite. If anybody goes back and listens to Ryan's remark, it was something to do close to the end that he had an issue with that I had the complete opposite feeling to. It was just something he didn't like, and I thought they did excellent this season. I thought everything was excellent. I thought they did all the characters very well, especially, except for Grog. They definitely left him in the shadow, but...
Sidelined.
Yeah.
Badly.
Yeah, that was a shame. But otherwise, it was very, very good. Looking forward to the next season.
Yeah. Although, just for the record, I don't know if it was Ryan who you're disagreeing with, because I feel like I had more critiques of this season than Ryan did. But
yeah, I just remember there being one specific one that it was definitely Ryan.
Okay. Well. Yep, Vox Machina, that was good stuff. I'm not mentioning it in any kind of depth, but I am still listening to Critical Role. I just today started the episode, which I guess would follow up Vox Machina season 3, where they jump forward a year. I mean, even though there's like a lot that happened before that time skip, I feel like this is where season 4 is going to pick up now. So I'd say I'm mostly getting caught up there. So I'm just going to go on like a 1, 2, 3, 4 bang kind of thing here. Just do these all at once. Let me preface, these are not normally my type of film. I would not associate, I'm not usually like into comedy movies. I'll watch them, but I certainly don't watch entire series most of the time. I feel like comedy and horror, usually I'll watch, if there's a whole series, I'll usually watch one and that's it. That's good enough. Usually sequels are just diminishing returns on these things, and I'm not that interested in the world or the characters. But in the span of about a week and a half, I watched all 4 installments of American Pie. So, yeah. And I'd never seen any of them before. Although I did know a lot of the references from the very first American Pie. I mean, even at D&D a couple weeks ago, like the night after I watched this movie, we were at D&D and Joe's like, this one time at band camp. I'm like, yep, I understand that reference. That's the classic. Although the funny thing about that, and I gotta say, is everyone just remembers the punchline to this one time at band camp. But you gotta remember, to me, it's funnier knowing that the joke wasn't just the punchline. The entire movie, it's set up with all these mundane stories. That's the part that people, I don't think,
it's the build up.
Mention enough. Yeah, it's all this buildup of mundane stories before the punchline. That's why this one time at band camp is a memorable gag.
Yeah, it makes it hit so much harder, because it's just like, it's just, and she says it so exactly like she would tell any of the other stories, and it's every like the other, only one that's interesting that they're like, what the? It's great.
Yeah, he's like, well, I bet nothing ever happened. Like, yeah, you don't have any more risque stories from band camp? Well, actually. The other thing I think about this movie is I'm pretty sure it also popularized the term MILF. There's this whole scene where, like, I'm pretty sure. I don't think I've ever seen a reference to MILFs before American Pie, at least in terms of movies. Like, this movie came out in the late 90s, I think 1999. And like, there's this whole scene where John Cho and his friend are like worshiping at the altar of Stifler's mom, like chanting MILF, MILF, MILF. And I'm like, this has to be one of the first times MILF was ever a thing in the mainstream. I might be wrong, but So I think that's where that might be where our culture's perception of MILFs came from, is Stifler's mom and John Cho. But this movie is chock full of cultural references I've heard all my life. Some of them I knew came from this film, like this one time at band camp, and other ones like the MILFs. I'm like, okay, well, I didn't know that was like a big American Pie thing. So the other thing I think about American Pie, and I think this is what gets lost, is that there is actually a pretty sizable thematic undercurrent in this film. You can just watch it for the raunchy humor and, like, you know, on the surface, it's just a teen sex drama. Okay. But under the surface, there is actually a pretty good coming of age story here where all these guys go through solid character growth. Like, I think of Oz in particular, which, okay, some spoilers for American Pie. But this is the guy who, from the first time he tries to seduce a woman, his go-to phrase is, "Suck me, beautiful." And he thinks that's going to work. This is the first time he thinks he's going to get lucky at the beginning of the movie. And that's what he goes with. And then the girl basically tells him, no, she laughs in his face and is like, no, this is not how you sleep with a woman. She basically gets, like, you have to be interested in what they're interested in, and you have to actually listen to them and develop an interest in them as a human being. And then Oz goes on this whole journey of, like, a self-discovery through listening to women talk and realizing he has other interests than just the lacrosse team. And Kevin, you know, he just wants to sleep with his girlfriend. He's very, like, he's very sex-minded, and he's just like, yeah, like, I've had this girlfriend for so long, I just want to sleep with her already. And he's also really afraid to say I love you to her the entire time. But as it goes on, he starts to, he's thinking all about himself in this sexual scenario, but then he starts to consider her needs in this scenario as well, and starts to, he develops his empathy more as well. And then there's Finch, who, you know, he thinks the best way to bed a woman is to spread all these stories about himself, about, you know, about how much of a badass he is. And then that all blows up in his face. And then there's Jim, who probably in the most dated part of the movie sets up this webcam live stream to catch this girl stripping. I'm like, okay, that bit probably aged the movie very poorly, because that would never fly today. Although he does get some comeuppance there, because him messing up that live stream ends up following him throughout all the four movies. Nobody remembers Nadia from that scene. They remember what happened to Jim for the rest of the franchise. That take, like, decades later, he's still hearing about that live stream. So, you know, Jim has consequences too. But basically they all learn, they're all going into sex, like trying to have sex, thinking like it's the be all and end all, but it's really more about the journey. They learn to, think of women more as human beings than as sex objects. They learn more about themselves in their quest to have sex than they do about sex itself. There's quite a bit there. And then in American Pie 2, I think I like the themes as well. It goes even deeper, actually, because there's even more nuance to it. Because American Pie 2 takes place about a year after the first, and they're trying to have this cool college party, and a lot of their girlfriends from the first movie come back. And it's very interesting that now they're a year past college. They don't just care about getting laid anymore. Now they yearn for relationships. They're more mature. They want the step beyond. And they're all kind of obsessed with the girls they had their first time with. for different reasons. And like with Kevin and Vicky, it's like, well, you know, I still kind of have a crush on you, but it's not really reciprocated. Heather and Oz, they're doing a long distance relationship. Finch is like, man, I've had so many women, but no one likes Stifler's mom. And, you know, they've all kind of got this obsessiveness about their first time still. Like they're all still missing that relationship component. They've had the sex, but now they want the next step. And that's what American Pie 2 is about. And personally, I laughed out loud even more in American Pie 2 than the first one, even though personally it was more crude and misogynistic, especially Stifler. But there is some nuance to these movies that I think people are like, oh yeah, American Pie, just the raunchy sex comedies. I'm like, no, there is more to it. Actually, it's not just what you think on the surface, except Stifler. Stifler is exactly what you think he is. That said, American Wedding basically is just that. It starts losing the nuance. And I think that's because Stifler becomes the main character in American Pie 3. And he's just a full-on cartoon in that one. American Wedding is also weird because they got rid of a lot of the other cast. Like Oz isn't even in it. I'm like, out of the four, like it's the core four guys and you trim one of them entirely. But I'm like, you know what? Okay, he had most of his arc in the first one and it was basically like side, like window dressing in the second one. He didn't really do a heck of a lot. So I'm like, I understand why you didn't want him, but he was still missed. Then they also made like weird lighting choices. It was too heightened in a dramatic way. Like American Wedding lost all the nuance. It was just more outright dumb. So like American Wedding's basically just a sex comedy. So I'd say the first one, first American Pie is pretty darn good. The second one I still think is worth a watch. The third one is if you turn your brain off. And then there's American Reunion, which takes place about 10 years after American Wedding. And that one felt more like a return to form, despite me still saying it's good only if you turn your brain off. But there's a little more nuance back to this one now, where all the guys are older, they're on the verge of their high school reunion, and they're all coming back to their hometown and feeling like something's missing in their lives. They're starting to get nostalgic for, you know, more of the events of the first one. And they want to add some spice back into their lives now being guys in their mid 30s. And so once again, it's kind of continuing the progression of American Pie 2. It's like, okay, so now we've had the sex, we've had the relationships. Now, what do we really want out of life at this point? Like, what do relationships look like in your 30s now? Like, they end up going to party with college girls and, like, high school girls, actually. Not even college girls. And, like, Stifler's totally into it. Like, yeah, man, partying with the high school girls. And everyone else is like, man, we're too old for this. This is... Like, we're all married now, and, like, what are we doing here partying with high school girls? So you start to see their maturity coming out a bit more. One thing about American Pie is it does the Back to the Future thing, where basically every movie does the same gags, but in a slightly different way. So if you've seen American Pie 1, it basically, there's a formula to all these movies, like even down to the last song on the credits being the same song in the soundtrack. Like it's like the opening gag is always like Jim gets caught in an embarrassing sexual situation. Like Stifler eats something gross at some point. There's worshiping of Stifler's mom. There's like John Cho shows up and his friends show up for 2 seconds to chant MILFs. For a while, there's a formula to these movies, but it's fun. I actually quite like this series. And Jim's dad is the best. That's another weird thing about American Pie is Jim's dad. And I got to talk a bit about Jim's dad because I feel like in 1999, even, it was very weird to have such a sex positive parent. Jim's dad is constantly catching Jim in the most embarrassing of situations. And the response is basically always, I'm going to give you advice that is very uncomfortable and you probably don't want to hear. And we're not going to tell mom about it. But I'm going to, you know, I'm going to give you some real earned wisdom here. And in the first one, Jim's just an embarrassed teenager, upset, like, oh, dad, don't talk about sex. I hate it. And he still hates it throughout the entire series. But as it goes on, he starts to appreciate his dad for being so open and candid with him and always giving the best advice. Like, their relationship is actually very refreshing in a genre comedy like this, where, you know, you'd expect the authority to figure to be like, oh, my son's having sex. How dare he? I got to stop him at every opportunity. And he was like, no, you know, I'm going to give you the porno magazines. I'm going to give you all this advice. I'm like encouraging you at every opportunity, even though you don't want to hear it. Like, Jim's dad is sort of the mascot for these movies. He's just a really awesome parent and role model. So that's my dissertation on the American Pie franchise. I'm sure I could go even more in depth, but the point is these movies are, they have more depth than they get credit for. Yeah, there's more to American Pie than you might think.
Yeah, they're all pretty good.
It's not all just this one time at band camp and a dick and an apple pie and yeah. Have you seen any more than just the first one?
I have seen the first two.
I mean, those are the best two. You need not go much further, but
yeah, if you don't want. Yeah, I heard that, so I just stopped after that.
I think if you're still like, if you're hardcore, you watch all four. If you're like a little less, I think you can skip American Wedding and just do the trilogy of 1, 2, and Reunion. I think Reunion's a perfect trilogy ender.
I might do that.
But if you're just like, yeah, but if you're just looking for, like, quality, the first two are the best. I think the second one's actually the funniest one, personally.
Yeah, I remember liking the second one better than the first one.
Yeah, which is weird. Like, it's a comedy movie and the second one's better? Wow.
That never happens. All right, well, I guess I'll do one. I am headed into my mid-tier garbage list, which it sounds like it's garbage, but it's not. It's mid-tier garbage. It's just mid-tier. It's just, like, nothing to write home about. It's not bad, but it's not particularly good. It's just, like, kind of disposable media in a way. It's mid-tier garbage. Mid-tier it's not garbage. Bad. It's not garbage. It's mid-tier garbage, you know? So I've got the Tower of Power series. I did books 1 to 4 by Ivan Cal. It's a lit RPG book. It's interesting. Like I said, it's just kind of mid-tier garbage. It's good. It's good enough. It's passable. It's got a little bit of interesting stuff to it, like the system itself, being a lit RPG, the systems is what makes them, really, I find. The system is pretty interesting in this one, but other than that, I don't know, the characters are pretty stock fantasy characters. I think that's the thing with lit RPG as a genre, is it's kind of like making fantasy easier. Where Lord of the Rings is like, yes, it's very difficult to make Legolas shooting his bow over and over interesting for a while. But, you know, Tolkien does it because he's a very good author. He's able to manage to keep these characters fresh, where that's hard to do as a writer. So, and I think that's kind of the cheat with lit RPG is that it's like, okay, we've got our fantasy characters, and now they level up, and they get new skills, and they have a whole new power set. Bam. Right there, you just refreshed your ability to make combat scenes interesting. Just like that.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a cheat to do fantasy, I think. But it makes it's interesting to read and listen to and stuff.
I like the idea of literature pulling from video games as a, you know, we don't really, stuff like Tolkien already kind of did the classic narrative fantasy so well, so let's borrow from another medium that people can understand.
Yeah.
And translate it to something else. How does RPG mechanics work in a novel?
Yeah, sure, like,
let's do that.
This one had all sorts of sort of like not D&D inspired, more like Pathfinder, because it's got like they pick classes, but then they start combining the classes into unique classes, and there's like different skill trees. But it's interesting because it's like the system in this one was like not really a hard system. It's kind of more loose, where it's like, actually, this is more like a guideline for powers that already technically existed in the universe. It's just the system is in your head to help you learn how to do it. It's like the cheat to go a little bit faster. But consistently, they're like, okay, well, the system, you know, when you think of a video game where you're like, okay, I want to put my skill point into here or here, or they can kind of force it to break. They can break stuff because it's not really a system. It's not a hard fixed video game system. It's still a world where they can kind of diverge on their own unique paths that the system was never designed for. And then it'll recalibrate and work towards that, even though it was never meant to do that, which is kind of unique. I haven't seen that done in any of these types of books, but it's pretty cool. Still just kind of mid-tier garbage. So I went through all four of them, and that's about all I can say about four books. So yeah, mid-tier garbage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I watched a historical World War II movie called The Monuments Men. And this is one I remember wanting to see when it came out, but I just never got around to it for some reason. Lots of great performances from a great cast. Basically, what The Monuments Men is about is during World War II, the Nazis stole as much artwork as they could from all the places that they conquered in Europe. And apparently Hitler was going to use these artworks to make a museum in Austria when they won the war. He was going to call it the Führer Museum. And it was going to be like nearly rewriting history by placing all these art pieces as conquests of Germany. And the idea is basically taking all this artwork from these cultures. I believe one of the monologues in the movie makes this point about you can conquer the people, but if you steal the things that the culture made, then you're like, that's how you really crush the culture. It's not by taking their land and oppressing their people. It's by erasing their history and their accomplishments. And then, you know, sticking it as a museum and claiming it for your own glory. So that's where the Monuments Men were created, where it was these artists in the Allies who ended up, you know, most of them were middle-aged men who just had backgrounds in art. They went through basic training, and their mission was to go through Europe and collect as many of these stolen artworks as they could and return them to their original owners just for the preservation of art. That was their entire thing. And yeah, they saw some combat for sure in the line of duty, but some of them even died trying to do this mission. But it was all about, look, the other soldiers are fighting to free the land. We're fighting to save the history while Europe's being bombed and just ripped apart and destroyed. We got to preserve some things for when this is all over. And it's a true story. It's based on a true story. Stars George Clooney. Plenty of other people were in it too. I'm forgetting off the top of my head, but Matt Damon as well. The problem with this movie was it's too character sparse to be character driven, and not enough of the investigation to be plot driven. So I'm like, it's neither character driven nor plot driven. It's just sort of like, it's this weird in between, which doesn't quite land, but I was always interested. The cast have great chemistry. I think the movie was worth a watch, if only just to see a slightly different side of World War II. Like, okay, yeah, these soldiers doing something that's not quite mainstream, but which we can all appreciate. Because you can go to Europe and you can see all the great artwork there, and like, well, that's largely because they helped recover it. Wouldn't be around to see today if it wasn't for them in a lot of cases. And going in a completely different direction again, I watched Trainspotting, which I thought was very intriguing as an uncompromising view of addiction. Everything from the camera work and the editing puts you in the mind of this addict played by Ewan McGregor. There's a lot of, I'd call it nonsensically sensical imagery. The editing has a weird flow of time and people and places. It's just like when this guy's high, you're nearly in it with him. You're experiencing the world as he experiences it. And like, it doesn't make any sense, but it also makes perfect sense at the same time. It's just like, it's a trip just watching these sequences. The actors are all excellent. This is maybe just a me problem, but I feel like I really needed the subtitles on this one because those Scottish accents are thick. The film in general is a touch horrific, but also disarmingly matter of fact. Like, the protagonist doesn't really care about what's happening. But that's also sort of the point, is that because he's in this cycle of drug addiction and the desperation which comes from it, the stuff that he's doing is like, well, man, yeah, of course, this is what I need to do. This is just, you know, this is what I have to do to live my life. But as a sober viewer watching it, you're like, man, your life is nuts. The stuff you're doing just to get a fix, man, this is insanity. But the character himself is like in the middle of all these atrocities and crimes, and he just doesn't care because he's just looking for his next fix. So I think Trainspotting is a must see. It's really well done. And I'll happily see the sequel if I ever get a chance. They only made that one a couple of years ago.
When did the first one come out?
Mid-90s.
Oh, wow. Oh, okay.
It's funny because I remember like my mom, for example, right? Like when Phantom Menace came out, they're like, they cast the drug addict guy from Trainspotting as Obi-Wan Kenobi. That was kind of, like, that was what Ewan McGregor was known for before Phantom Menace.
Wow.
Trainspotting. That was his first big movie.
All right. Well, the next one I got on my list, another mid-tier garbage one, with the most generic title ever, The Strange Case by Derek Kolsted.
That is the most generic title I've ever heard.
The Strange Case. It's so generic. It's basically, I can describe it super, super fast. It's MK Ultra meets Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde combined. That's about it. That's good. It's fine. It's okay. Mid-tier garbage. It's passable. It's entertaining enough. There's nothing really wrong with it. It's just not that good. It's not particularly good. It's not particularly bad. It's just good enough. There you go. Mid-tier garbage. That's all I got to say about that one.
What was this one about?
It's a girl with the split personalities. Actually, it's almost the one thing, as I was listening to it, I'm like, is this just Moon Knight? Is it just Moon Knight? It's the split personalities. It's just Moon Knight. It's basically Moon Knight. The other personality is an assassin. It's Moon Knight goes to therapy. That's it. And we're the perspective of the therapist learning about Moon Knight.
Okay, that's a better pitch for it.
But it's more along the lines of like MK Ultra rather than like superheroes. Like government brainwashing stuff.
I'm more intrigued now.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I watched Gangs of New York, which was pretty good. Daniel Day-Lewis especially was the standout of this film. He plays Bill the Butcher with his entire body. It's just, like, it's not just his delivery. Like, he inhabits this character with everything in him. Just a all-around exceptional performance. My problem with this movie, well, one of them, was it seemed like a cool twist on a revenge tale until it goes basically where you think it'll go. Because the first minor, well, some spoilers for the first half of the movie anyway. So Daniel Day-Lewis's character kills Liam Neeson, who's Leonardo DiCaprio's father in this movie. And Leonardo DiCaprio, he was a child at the time his dad was killed and he's sent away. And then he comes back to New York as a grown man. And then he ends up joining the gangs of New York and ends up working for Bill the Butcher, who's the guy who killed his dad. But it nearly seems like in the first half of this movie, his whole plan is to kill Bill the Butcher under the guise of just being this guy who's working up the ranks. But it nearly seems like he's actually developing a respect for Bill. Like, well, I can't place my plan into motion to kill him yet, but having to have to spend all this time with my father's killer, I've actually gotten to know him pretty well, and he's a very personable kind of guy. And that was the part of the movie that seemed the most interesting to me. I'm like, it's this revenge tale where the hero's revenge is sort of stymied partway through because he actually kind of ends up liking the guy he wants to kill. Now that he's come back as an adult man and the guy he wants to kill starts seeing him as a son figure, like the son he never had. And I'm like, that was the interesting bit of the movie to me until it just abandons all of that halfway through. And I'm like, oh, well, now it's just a basic revenge tale. All right. The third act stuff is also weird because it feels like the seeds were there all along for it to sprout, but it also feels like the stuff they put in the third act took way too much focus from the core of the movie. Like, it suddenly becomes like a political revolution sort of thing and gets completely away from the revenge tale. Like, three quarters of the stuff that's happening is not about the main characters anymore. And I'm like, what is happening? It's just chaos. Basically, started great, lost steam. Sets and costumes were excellent. I love the lived-in vibe of New York. Everything looks used and abused and crowded and detailed. Production design's excellent. I mean, it's a Scorsese movie. There's a certain bar of quality here. So overall, Gangs of New York, pretty good. Lots I liked about it. Lots I wish it went a different way. plot and script wise. So then I've got The Flash, Finish Line by Joshua Williamson, Christian Deuce, Rafa Sandoval, Jordi Tarragona, Scott Collins, and Howard Porter. And so The Flash Finish Line is, well, the finish to Joshua Williamson's run on The Flash, which, what is this, volume 15? So Joshua Williamson did 15 volumes of The Flash, which is many, many issues. So what is that up to now? Okay, well, that doesn't help me. Up to The Flash 762. So 15 volumes times 6 to 7 issues a volume. You do the math. The guy has made a lot of Flash comics. And his run is actually pretty noteworthy. He moved a lot of the mythology of The Flash forward. And The Flash TV show was actually running while this Joshua Williamson run was going on. And the later seasons of The Flash TV show, I'd say probably seasons 6 through 8, loosely adapted a lot of Joshua Williamson's stories for those seasons. And to be clear, the show did it more poorly, in case people are seeing the show's version as a detriment to Williamson's storytelling. But yes, even The Flash show in its current run was taking from the current run of Flash comics, because Joshua Williamson created so much lore for The Flash. As for this particular volume, the art, not really to my taste. I found the faces a little strange. The plot was also stretched more thin than I would like, and doesn't really pay off till the final issue. But it's a great final issue. The bit with Professor Zoom at the end, especially, I remember that was adapted very closely in The Flash TV show for one of its all-time best moments. And I'm like, oh, so even that moment was from a Joshua Williamson comic. Cool. So this particular volume, great ending, capped off Williamson's run nicely in that final issue, but best enjoyed if you turn off your brain, except for the final issue, which is a must read for Barry Allen fans. What do you have next?
So my last thing I got, one more mid-tier garbage, is...
Sorry, also your webcam is shut off for me.
Yes, yeah, the battery died.
Boo his.
Okay. Yes. Sorry, you can't see my beautiful face anymore. So it's the Coldest Case, the sequel by James Patterson. It's not as good as the first one was. And maybe that's just because it's the second, like it's a sequel. And it just doesn't have that same ability to tell a cohesive story. Not exactly. I mean, it you know, it's just carrying over. It's just more boring than the first one. And it's just, it's okay. It's like a, I just realized I didn't describe it yet. It's like a detective family, basically. They're all, you know, the dad is like the chief of police, and the sister and the brother are both detectives, and...
Sure, yeah.
This one kind of deals with, like, the family secrets, you know, like, was dad a dirty cop, or was his partner dirty, or whatever. And it was okay. It was decent. It's well written. Like, James Patterson does a good job of writing things. It's just not the most engaging story, but it's well written, and it's passable enough. Mid-tier garbage.
All right. And are you done with yours, or how many more do you have?
That I think that's all I've got. Yeah.
Okay, I got one more. So I watched the 1996 version of Emma, Jane Austen's Emma. with the Gwyneth Paltrow movie. Anyway, I thought the movie was excellently paced. I know a lot of people seem to disparage this movie for its accuracy to the source material, but I haven't read Emma, so I'm just judging this based on the movie. I don't even have that much familiarity with the story of Emma. So as far as this version goes, the Gwyneth Paltrow one, I think it's excellently paced. The dialogue is quick and witty and, for far as I can tell, well written. I especially enjoy the period sounding noble speak. It lends an air of authenticity to this time and place. Well delivered as well. Acting is awesome. And as for the character of Emma herself, I think it's interesting how much of a brat she is as a main character. Because she makes one good match. She's a matchmaker, a wannabe matchmaker. She makes one good match at the start of the book, at the start of the movie, which ends in a wedding. Good for her. And now she thinks she knows who's best to pair her with anybody. So then she ends up basically... She basically ends up trying to be the steward for her friend's love life and just steering her wrong very blatantly in every regard. The second half of the movie was more interesting when she was having to play the defense. Because most of the first half of the movie, she's on the offensive and just, you know, coming across like a brat who really needs to be put in her place. And then the back half is when she starts getting put in her place. Much deserved. More interesting character when she had to consider her actions a little bit more. To me, the standout about this movie was its camera work and blocking, because I know it seems like a mundane, like a little bit of a mundane movie about just, you know, these people's romantic lives are the biggest thing in their lives, and you know, it's all really low stakes and everything. But I was especially impressed with the blocking and the camera work and the editing in this movie, because it's all very theatrical and incredibly efficient, because the way these characters are placed required the camera to move as little as possible. There was a lot of, like, the way they moved in scene let the camera do most of the work in a point of view and allowed the editing to not be cutting between things every 2 seconds. The actors could just run the scenes a lot of times and the camera would just be our window into the scene. Like, it was just incredibly efficient storytelling, which I think is partially why I felt it was so fast, like so well paced, because there was just a lot of everything there was only necessary, not a lot of wasteful cutting back and forth for stuff just to say, hey, we're showing this guy's face now in close ups. And like, no, it didn't do anything it didn't need to do, which inspires me as a filmmaker, and hopefully I want to be able to put that kind of efficiency in our films going forward. Yeah. So that is Emma, and that is our leisure lists. Where can we find you?
You can find me at JChurchTPM on Instagram and ThoughtPlane Media on YouTube.
And you can find me on Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook at ThoughtPlane Media. Also, check out the Close Up with Ryan and Joe Facebook page for latest updates on the show. If you listen to us in audio, check out our YouTube channel. And if you're on YouTube, find us anywhere you get your favorite podcasts. We hope to see you on the next Close Up with Ryan and Joe. I can't guarantee it won't be another leisure list, but we'll see what comes up a few weeks from now. Till next time.
Take care.